When Stephen Sondheim was young, his mentor was his neighbor, the celebrated lyricist Oscar Hammerstein. Now Stephen Sondheim is Broadway's foremost composer and lyricist, the one who more than anyone else has connected the Broadway tradition of Rodgers and Hammerstein to the adventurous harmonies and dissonances of contemporary music. Sondheim is the winner of a Pulitzer Prize, and he's the only composer-lyricist to win a Tony Award 3 consecutive years. His shows include A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Company, Follies, A Little Night Music, Sweeney Todd, Sunday in the Park with George, and the current hit, Into the Woods. Even if you're not familiar with those shows, you probably know his song, Send in the Clowns. Sondheim started on Broadway as a lyricist, collaborating with Leonard Bernstein on West Side Story and with Julie Stein on Gypsy. Sondheim rarely gives interviews, but today he was lecturing at the University of Pennsylvania in a series featuring writers affiliated with PEN, the International Writers Organization, and he paid us a brief visit. Sondheim told me that just before he started writing for Broadway, he worked as a writer for the TV series Topper.
I had earned some money. I was on a scholarship for 2 years after I got out of college, and when the money ran out, I needed a job. So I got a job writing as an assistant writer for the Topper series.
I have to tell you, that was about my favorite show when I was a kid. One of the greatest joy about getting sick was being able to stay home in the morning and watch the Topper reruns. Was that a useful learning experience for you?
Very, very. It's to learn to tell a story in 23 and a half minutes, in four acts, so that you have a teaser, and then three commercial breaks, and to structure each tiny little act so it has a sort of shape and has a punchline and an exit line for characters. And also the leading lady had trouble with her S's, so we had to try to keep plurals singular verbs out of the script.
It's a good writing exercise.
Very good indeed. No, it was very, very good. That kind of discipline is extremely useful.
Your first Broadway work was with Leonard Bernstein writing the lyrics for West Side Story.
No, I wrote the lyrics. He wrote the music. Oh, you said with Leonard Bernstein writing the lyrics.
No, I'm sorry. No. There was no punctuation in that sentence. No. You were writing the lyrics. He was writing the music.
Yeah.
You didn't like the idea of starting as a lyricist, though?
No, I was trained as a composer, and that's what I wanted to do. I'd majored in music, and I'd studied music on a scholarship with Milton Babber for 2 years. And it was an accident, and I wouldn't have done it except that Oscar thought it was a good idea for me to do it because Bernstein and Jerry Robbins and Arthur Lawrence were seasoned professionals, and I was, 25 years old, and he thought it would be a good learning experience for me, and he was right.
West Side Story was about gangs. You were from an upper-middle-class family. Was it hard to...
No, it wasn't really about gangs. It was about... Well, really, it's about the theater is what West Side Story is about.
And about the theater.
Yeah. It's about theater techniques. It's not really about gangs. That's the story. It's Romeo and Juliet, it is. And it's just a transposition of Romeo and Juliet. So gangs, indeed, it was. But the only research that was done was Jerry Robbins went to a dance in which there were two rival gangs, and he noticed that one gang gave carnations to each of the girlfriends. And so he used that up until the dress rehearsal of West Side Story in Washington, where in the dance hall sequence, all the sharks the girls gave the guys flowers, is what it was, and they put them in the cuffs of their trousers. And what Jerry hadn't realized was as soon as they would start dancing all over the stage became awash in flowers. It looked like a funeral. And so that was cut. But that was the only authentic moment, which was swiftly taken out. Arthur Lawrence very early on realized that there was no point in trying to be realistic about gang language, for example, because slang and argot, as you know, change every 2 months, and he knew that by the time we got the show on, any authentic talk he made would be outdated, so he made up all the language. And that's what we all decided to do, that the whole show should really be about imagination. Jerry indeed did some research and used to post things backstage for the cast on various gang incidents that would occur during the course of the rehearsals to give the actors some sense of the social milieu from which the characters came. But as far as we, the authors, went, we did no research at all.
Those are the first lyrics you wrote that got performed on Broadway. They've become classics. When you listen back to them, how do you feel about them?
I didn't like them then, and I don't like them now. And there are two lyrics I like. The rest of them sound very written to me.
Which ones are the ones that you like?
Something's Coming and the Jet Song. The others are, you know, they're very self-conscious. But that was partly Lenny's influence, because he very much wanted the show to be important, and that to him important meant that the lyrics should be, quote, poetic. And his idea of poetic and mine are different. And I think what he really wanted was purple prose, and I wanted simplicity, which is what I'd gotten from Oscar. So I think the lyrics are very self-conscious. I was bending over to please everybody, of course, because I was so young. And so I find, you know, except for the occasional line, I think they're pretty embarrassing.
You worked with Julie Stein on Gypsy. You wrote the lyrics
for that. That was the next show, yes.
Now, in his autobiography, he said one of the things he liked about working with you is that you never asked for extra notes. does that mean, like, if you find a three-syllable word that you think is just perfect, that you beg the composer for two extra notes?
No, well, no, this, no, actually, no. I think. first of all, most of the lyrics in Gypsy, the music sort of followed the lyrics. That say, I would write sample quatrains or couplets and give them rhythms to work from. No, in fact, I'd never do that anyway. When I work with a composer, I've only worked with three, but once in West Side Story, I asked for extra syllables. I mean, a number of the tunes in West Side Story were taken out of Candide that were not used in Candide. One of them was a song called One, which was composed of dotted half notes, and it went one hand, one heart. But I said, when we got to Washington, I said, it's just too few notes there, and the words just too heavy and too pretentious, and at least, you know, if you give me three-quarter notes instead of one dotted half, I would appreciate it. Well, the lyric's still pretty pretentious, but it's not as pretentious as it was. Maybe Julie had that from other people. I don't believe though, like everybody else, I often tend to be verbose when I write lyrics. I try to fight against it. And I remember Oscar used to set me exercises in theory and say, you know, write a whole note melody and a whole note lyric, a whole note meaning, you know, where you have to sustain a note. Like he wrote a song called Who with Jerome Kern. Who stole my heart away. Well, if you hear that tune, it's hard to set that lyric, because you've got to find a word where the singer can sustain the vowel sound and where it's natural punctuation, and it's hard to do. And I think most lyric writers tend to be verbose, and I think that's what Julie was probably referring to, was that, you know, I'd been trained quite the reverse way. Not that there aren't wordy lyrics in Gypsy, but there aren't very many of them.
You started doing music and lyrics. You started doing your own shows. The first was A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum.
That was right after Gypsy.
And the second was Anyone Can Whistle. Forum was, I think, a big success. Whistle closed pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
What was the effect of a failure on your career early on, after you'd had so many successes?
Well, I hadn't had so many successes.
Oh,
I had West Side
ones,
Story and
ones.
Gypsy and
yeah.
Forum. Yes, but West Side and Gypsy...
They weren't all yours.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Forum was a big success, although I got terrible reviews. Everybody, the reviews were almost unanimous in saying the show was a success in spite of what I had done. So I hadn't had any success.
Uh-huh.
I was only disappointed that more people wouldn't get to see Anyone Can Whistle. I always wondered what would happen when I had my first so-called failure, but I realized that since the others weren't personal successes anyway, because I got slammed by the critics for both West Side and Gypsy. They said how terrible the lyrics were, and then when I wrote music, they said the music was even worse than the lyrics. So I was used to getting slammed, so that had no effect on me. But the short run of the show depressed me, because I wanted more people to see it.
When you started writing your own music, did you feel like you were carrying on the tradition of Rodgers and Hammerstein in any way, or did you feel like you were breaking from that?
Oh, no, it was Rodgers and Hammerstein, certainly, absolutely.
What about what they had done felt like what you were doing? What is the tradition exactly?
Oh, it's a tradition. It's something Oscar really started with Showboat. He combined the whole European operetta idea with the American musical comedy idea. And the American musical comedy idea was, you know, a series of songs with jokes in between. And the operetta idea was a series of, you know, Graustarkian situations with outlandish romantic variations on them. And essentially an excuse for singers to let forth with large romantic or choral pieces. And with Showboat, he attempted to bring some realism into the musical theater and to combine the two so that they became what you could call a musical play. Not an opera, but a musical play. And somewhere between an operetta and a musical comedy. And that was not taken up very much by other people during the 30s. and Oscar tried a few himself, and they failed. So it wasn't until Oklahoma came along and was such a gigantic success that the movement was resuscitated. And after that, virtually everybody started to write what they call integrated musicals, in which the songs carry the story forward instead of just being respites and moments between jokes and block comedy scenes. And that's essentially what I was doing.
I want to play one piece that you've written, and this is from your opera, Sweeney Todd. And I thought it might be interesting to...
It's nice to call it an opera, but please, let's call it a musical.
Call it a musical. Yeah, why would you prefer that to opera?
Well, because it doesn't belong in an opera house. Though it's mostly sung, there's a good deal of dialogue in it, and I'd say about 20% is dialogue. And it's not for operatic voices. It's not about the singer. Operas are about the singer, not about the opera.
Yeah, why don't you like to write for operatic voices, by the way?
Because they push it. They're interested in the voice and not in the material. And I'm interested in the material. And that's just the way they're trained, and that's what audiences come to hear. Audiences do not come to hear the piece, they come to hear the singers.
Well, from Sweeney Todd, what I've chosen to play is a part called The Epiphany, and this is a part where the whole character of the main character changes. Throughout the show, he's been interested in revenge against one person, and it's a kind of just revenge that he's seeking. But when his revenge is thwarted, he becomes pathological and is interested in killing anybody who enters his barbershop. He'll take any head that walks in. This is a turning point. Before we hear it, just tell me a little bit about the challenge that writing this presented to you.
Well, the piece is based on a play by an English playwright named Christopher Bond, an excellent version of this story, which has been told for 130 years, 150 now. And it's always been a kind of 19th-century melodrama with blood and guts and thunder sheets. And as such, it was always very uninteresting till this young playwright, Christopher Bond, a British playwright, got hold of it in the 70s. He was with an acting troupe, and they were going to put it on for their Christmas show. And they read it. The scripts arrived a little late, and they read it, and they only had 3 weeks to go, and they realized how terrible even the last version was, which had been, I think, 1956 was the last version that was written. So he said, don't worry about it, I'll rewrite it. And he rewrote it, and he changed, kept the essential plot, which is about a murderer, mass murderer, and who kills people in his barber chair, and who's colleague, Mrs. Lovett, turns them into meat pies and becomes the most successful entrepreneur of meat pies in London as a result. And he motivated it by giving Sweeney Todd this whole revenge motive, which was never, ever part of the story. And the only difficulty he had in motivating the whole play was turning the personal revenge into mass revenge, which, of course, didn't matter in the originals, because in the originals he was just this kind of crazed, greedy murderer who killed people for their money. And that was not the case with Bond's version. And I had to figure out some reason to justify the moment. Bond justified the moment with a single sentence, which even he admitted was sort of a weak stab, which Sweeney said, in effect, I've tasted blood and now my thirst is great. And I'd never bought that, and neither, I think, did Chris Bond. So I try to think of a reason that he would turn from being a single-minded murderer into this kind of crazed mass murderer. And I came up with this notion in The Epiphany, which has to do with the social situation and really has to do with the lower classes and the upper classes, which is something that Bond, who was and is a sort of left-wing playwright, had touched on but hadn't used for this particular moment. And what Sweeney does in effect is blame the world for his difficulties, for his problems, for the rape and suicide of his wife. And in fact, he's right. And so to blame the social structure for his personal tragedy gave me the key so that he could then say, and now I will kill everybody in the social structure, high and low. And that's what it amounts to.
Okay, let's hear the part where he has this revelation, this epiphany. This is from Sweeney Todd.
There's a hole in the world like a great black pit, and it's filled with people who are filled with shit, and the vermin of the world inhabit it. But not for long. They all deserve to die. reply, Mrs. Love, and tell you why. Because in all of the whole human race, Mrs. Lovett, there are two kinds of men and only two. There's the one staying put in his proper place, and the one with his foot in the other one's face. Look at me, Mrs. Lovett, look at you. Though we all deserve to die, tell you why, Mrs. Lovett, tell you why. Because the lives of the wicked should be made brief for the rest of us. Death will be a relief. We all deserve to die. And I'll never see Joanna. No, I'll never hug my girl to be finished. All right, you sir, how about a shave? Come and visit your good friend, Sweeney. You sir, too sir, welcome to the grave. I will have vengeance. I will have salvation. Who, sir? You, sir? No one's in the chair. Come on, come on! Sweeney's waiting. I want you, breeders. You, sir? Anybody? Gentlemen, now don't be shy. Not one man, no, nor ten men, nor I. And I will get him back even as he gloats. In the meantime, I'll practice on less honorable throats. And my Lucy lies in ashes, and I'll never see my girl again. But the work waits. I'm alive.
The Epiphany from Sweeney Todd. I love the lyric for this, and I think it's rough language for Broadway and a rough sentiment for Broadway as well. Can I just quote some of it in case people
sure.
missed it? If you don't mind me doing this. There's a hole in the world like a great black pit, and it's filled with people who are filled with shit, and the vermin of the world inhabit it, but not for long. They all deserve to die, tell you why, Mrs. Lovett, tell you why. Can you tell me anything about writing that?
No,
they all deserve to die. Tell you why.
Well, first of all, it picks up the whole there's a hole in the world like a great black pit. Is a pickup of a theme that he sings earlier in mm-hmm. the show. The Epiphany actually combines a number of themes, including the Dies Irae, which is an underlying
yeah.
motif of the whole show, and which is when the chugging vamp comes in there. That's what's being played hidden in the orchestra is the Dies Irae. And it's the first open statement because the other references to the Dies Irae in the show are either sequential or not quite, but this is the first time it actually locks in. As far as that lyric goes, no. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just stating it. He's saying we're all lost in the social structure. There is no hope for the world. It's a Dickensian view, which is, you know, in fact, Hal Prince staged it so that the rich folk were always kind of on an upper level looking down at the poor folk. And what he's saying is that in such a structure, everybody loses. You know, it's this kind of structure that breeds revolution, which is in fact what Sweeney is doing. He's got a one-man revolution. He is the French Revolution by himself. He's killing not just the rich, of course. He's killing indiscriminately. He's killing everybody. But that's what he means by we all deserve to die, even you, even I. I mean, as he says, there are only two ways, one on top and one on the bottom, and they're both, the ones on top should be killed and the ones on bottom get killed.
I want to talk with you more about your music, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Stephen Sondheim. We'll be back in a few seconds. This is Fresh Air. Composer Stephen Sondheim is my guest. You don't orchestrate your own music.
No.
And most of your music has been orchestrated by Jonathan Tunick.
Since Company, yes, with exception of Sunday in the Park.
How much information do you have on your piano sheet when you give it to your orchestrator?
It's extremely complete because I was trained classically, so all the lines are in there. All that stuff is in there. The orchestrator adds nothing except chooses the instruments, and occasionally Because the piano is my instrument, Jonathan will have to take a piano figuration and make it sound in the orchestra, which is not always as easy as it might seem. And he will sometimes supply sustained lines, usually high up, not in this piece, but in some of the ballad pieces, because I keep forgetting that that when a note doesn't sustain on the piano, you know, when you've got your foot on the sustaining pedal and it goes off, I keep forgetting that the violin can make it go on, so I always strike the note again. And so Jonathan will occasionally do that, but no, I'm meticulous and careful about all the contrapuntal stuff.
The laugh that we heard in the Epiphany, was that written in to your
score? No, as a matter of fact, no, I'd worked it out so that because he was going to be on this sort of second floor where his barbershop is and then come down. Originally, I wanted him to sing it all up there, and Hal Prince, the director, said he wanted to bring him downstage. Well, in order to bring him downstage, we had to get him down a flight of stairs and onto the apron of the stage, and I had one passage where he could do that to get down, but I didn't really have a passage for him to go up. That is to say, there was a pause in the music, but in order to cover the cross to the staircase so it wouldn't seem like dead air, Len, I don't know whether, because it happened during rehearsal, I don't know whether Hal suggested it to Len or whether Len Carey, the guy who plays Sweeney, or whether it was Len's idea, but there was this kind of insane laugh. It's not my favorite moment because it's just vaguely, just vaguely camp to have a villain go, eh, eh, eh. But we needed something to cover the cross, and that's how that happened.
I think it's terrific.
Len is so frightening in the performance. It works. But in the hands of a less good actor, an insane laugh is, you know, high school stuff.
You know, it seems to me that in all your songs, you always bring in very specific elements of the drama that's
yes,
going
well,
on.
I'm into that. I'm into sort of naturalistic songwriting. And like The Worst Pies in London in that show, you know, I worked out where she's dusting, blowing dust off her pies and slapping roaches and things like that. It's all worked into the music. Each slap and each blow, and I like working that kind of thing. And it first of all, it helps the director to give him a very specific blueprint of what the action should be, so that if he wants to change it, he can. But he has something to work from, and he doesn't have to turn to you and say, "Well, how do I fill this moment?" And I like to. I think it's fun to write songs, you know, for people who have colds or who stutter or who cough or who can't remember what they're saying. The kinds of things we do in real life.
Is that why you like to work in the setting of Broadway shows? Because there are details of a story to work into a song. It's not just a generic love song. There's characters. There's
well,
movements to
Broadway shows
into
usually
it.
Are generic. It's the rare Broadway show that doesn't. Why do you say Broadway? You said do I like I like to work in?
No,
the,
I mean as opposed to just writing songs.
Oh,
supposed
oh,
to
you
just
mean
sitting at home writing songs?
Oh, you don't mean Broadway. You mean dramatic structure.
Dramatic structure.
Sorry.
Thank
oh,
you.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure, that's exactly why. Yes, I'd much rather write for character and situation. I wouldn't know how to just write a song because I would have to invent a character in a situation if you asked me to write a song. The few songs I've written, like, for, I don't know, people's birthdays and things like that, that I've written apart from dramatic situations, I've had to invent the dramatic situation or take it out of a real-life situation.
Have you ever taken a lyric of yours and changed it because you thought it was too clever?
No, I've taken it. Yes, I have. When I think that the audience isn't getting it, or when I think it's out of character, I did it in Into the Woods. There was a nice couplet in a song called No More, and it was very graceful, and it was too graceful for the character. Yes, I will take it out sometimes, not often, because I usually do that in my study while I'm writing it. When I think that it's either out of character, or when I think that it may be something difficult for the audience to assimilate quickly, because the whole point of a song is, as opposed to a poem, which you can read at your own speed, the lyric goes by at its speed, and you have to catch up with it. So it's up to the lyric writer and the composer to make it clear to the audience, at the same time, not lag behind them, nor be so far ahead of them that they get baffled. So sometimes you have to underwrite lyrics for just that purpose. You have to give them air, and you have to make the lyrics simpler than you would if it was on paper.
I know that you collect puzzles and you're interested in puzzles. Is lyric writing similar to a puzzle?
Oh, sure.
And the problems you have to solve?
All art is. All you have to solve it. Same thing as with a painting or with a novel. I mean, you're always solving problems of structure, architecture, and things like that. In lyrics, I think it's more critical because there are so many fewer words. I don't know what kind of a... I just violated some basic speech. So many fewer words. But at any rate, there are fewer words, and therefore each one becomes important. Also, since I believe in writing lyrics that reflect the inflection of regular speech, the rise and fall of the language, and how long you sustain a word in a given line becomes, to my ear anyway, critical if you're trying to give the impression of naturalistic speech. One of the problems with Sweeney Todd was I didn't want the audience to laugh at this melodrama. I mean, we do live in the 20th century, and people don't go for this kind of blood and thunder stuff anymore, and it's much more horrible out on the street than it is on the stage. But I also didn't want them to think that they were, quote, at an opera. So one of the triumphs for me of Sweeney Todd is I look around the second act at the audience's face. They don't know that people are singing. They really think they're talking because they're so involved with the story and what's going to happen next and who's going to get killed next. They don't realize they're being sung at. And that's a result of lyric writing being so seeming like dialogue. And that kind of stuff comes through a lot of sweat. And that's what working out a puzzle is.
One last question. A lot of composers really love to play their own stuff at parties and to get on the stage whenever anyone will let them and perform. You seem to rarely perform your own work. You don't like to perform?
No, I don't. I played a lot. I performed a lot when I was a kid. When I was in when I was at George School, I played some recitals around Pennsylvania, and I also acted a lot while I was in college. And one day, I just woke up and thought, "What am I doing in public?" And from then on, I always wanted to hide in the shadows. I'm not a performer by nature, and except privately. I like to play the piano for friends, or particularly for a collaborator. I like to demonstrate a song, but I do it when I have to. But it's something that does not give me a kick at all.
Well, I thank you very much for spending some time with us. Thank you.
Righto.
Stephen Sondheim is in Philadelphia today, teaching at the Penn at Penn program. That's a lecture series co-sponsored by the University of Pennsylvania and Penn, the International Writers Organization. Sondheim's current hit musical, Into the Woods, is in its second year on Broadway. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.